My name is Laurent Guyenot. I'm 63 years old, so of course I've been through different kind of things, but I had originally an engineering degree, but then much later I got into studying history of religion and this kind of thing, and I ended up doing a PhD on medieval studies when I was 40 years old. And in 2010 or 2011, suddenly I came out of the Middle Age. I was into the Middle Age, and I saw some videos about 9/11, and that kind of got me. It was a shock, so my whole focus changed, and I started to research about 9/11, and then I ended up being fascinated by the story of Kennedy. And also from the time I realized that basically it leads to Israel in both cases, then I started to really study what is Israel. And of course, I had some biblical also background. I had studied the Bible when I was younger. So I started to try to understand Israel, you know, and the biblical roots of Israel, and kind of got to realize that the problem of Israel today is actually rooted in the Bible. So I wrote this book, From Yahweh to Zion, which was translated actually by Kevin Barrett in English. That's about it. I'm still into all those topics. I like the Middle Age, so sometimes I explore kind of mysterious issues connected to the Middle Age. For example, I worked on Byzantium and trying to understand why Byzantium has been erased from our Western history. Well, this kind of topic is also interesting, but it also connects with the Bible and all these kind of things.
Yeah, look, I mean, I first came across you, as I'm sure some others may well have done, with this documentary, Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, which came out a couple of years ago. Can you tell us, take us on the little journey that you had through, mm-hmm. first of all, discovering that there was this connection, and secondly, what were the main points that stood up the connection between Israel and these two horrific assassinations in the United States after World War II in the 1960s?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's put it this way. I started the book that made me interested in Kennedy, in John Kennedy, was James Douglas, the JFK and the Unspeakable, came out in 2008, I think. So, you know, that was the start, and that's a kind of bestseller today. So I think it's the most popular book on John Kennedy's assassination. But, you know, as I had studied also 9/11, and I started to wonder why there is no, I started to wonder if by any chance there was an also connection to Israel. And of course, quite quickly, I ended up reading Michael Collins Piper's book. You know, Michael Collins Piper is an American researcher, investigator. He died, I think, in 2014 or something. But he was the one who pioneered the quest for, well, you know, looking into Israel as a possible suspect in the Kennedy assassination. And actually, he has tons of things to say. And so he used a new revelation that came out in the early 1990s about John Kennedy's struggle with David Ben-Gurion over Israel's project to get the nuclear bomb, you know. So I'm not going to get into the detail, but that's that completely, if you know this story, it completely changes your perspective on Kennedy's assassination, because here you have on one side David Ben-Gurion, who really believed to get the nuclear weapon was absolutely vital for his country. It was a matter of survival for him. You know, he felt Israel, his small country, surrounded by hostile Arab states and so on. So, you know, there's this absolutely unchangeable policy of Israel since David Ben-Gurion, that Israel has to have the atomic weapon and nobody else has to have the atomic weapon around them. You know, that's the two sides of the Israeli nuclear policy. And on the other side, you have John Kennedy, who was absolutely determined to engage a disarmament of nuclear weapons in the world. He had this vision. He felt atomic, you know, nuclear weapons are absolutely evil, and he had as his priority on the international level to abolish them. We have many speeches of him. We know how he corresponded with Khrushchev on that topic. And so, you know, that really creates a very strong case. And that's only one point. There are many other points. You know, there is the fact that we don't know who shot Kennedy. We know it wasn't Oswald, but actually we know who shot Oswald, and that's Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby's real name is Jacob Rubinstein. And he was connected not to the Chicago Sicilian Mafia, you know, as many people would imagine, but to the, you know, the Jewish network, the Jewish underworld, which was very intimately connected to the Irgun, and you know, and Jack Ruby was part of this world. So, you know, there's, you know, about five very strong clues that to solve the Kennedy assassination, we have to look toward Israel. So I became more and more convinced. The more I studied, the more I became convinced of that. So I made a film and I made a book called The Unspoken Kennedy Truth. And that's an ironic reference to James Douglas, The Unspeakable, because what James Douglas doesn't speak about is what he leaves unspoken is precisely Israel. There's not one word about Israel in Kennedy assassination books.
I mean, I think the other thing, of course, is that you are most definitely going to be accused of anti-Semitism, particularly rather than looking at a kind of Zionist mafia, which is connected with the creation of the Israeli state. I mean, just to be talking about these individuals involved in the Kennedy assassination as Jewish, I mean, there is a bit of a separation, and it seems that you may have fallen into the trap of conflating the two. So can you just clear that one up?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, that's a very sensitive, you know, trail to walk on. So that's why you have to be very careful. Well, when I say Jewish, you know, I just mean Jewish in the way Jewish people understand it, you know. But, you know, we're talking about Israel, but we're talking about Israel as a country with also many people in the United States, in particular, who are deeply loyal. You know, we may call them Sayanim in one way or another. So when, you know, we have to understand that Israel is a state in the Middle East, but it's also some kind of international organization, because the Irgun recruited in the organized crime in the United States for people to smuggle weapons and also even to smuggle nuclear material. So, you know.
Yeah, but Jewish is also a religion, isn't it? You know, these guys with the funny hats with a wide brim, you know, how do they fit into the mix, if at all?
I don't know. They don't necessarily fit. You know, I'm talking about some kind of international organization. Of course, Jew can be also religion and have no connection to that. Yeah, of course. Of course. If that's what you mean, yes, of course, that's clear.
I mean, in my own investigations, Laurent, I've dug up this character, James Files, from the Chicago Mafia, who gives a pretty convincing series of confessions of his involvement with the Kennedy assassination. So, I mean, he and Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli, all apparently down in Dallas that fateful day. And their controller was this guy, James Atlee Phillips, at the CIA. And so can you just go to the heart of the specifics to do with the mafia involvement in shooting Kennedy? And also, why would the CIA get involved? Did the Israelis, the Zionists, have some specific hold over the CIA?
Well, yes, they did, through James Jesus Angleton. But, you know, it's important to talk about James Jesus Angleton. But just before that, I think we have to distinguish different levels, you know. So you know, some people were hired to shoot, you know, to kill Kennedy, to set up the ambush and so on. These people were, of course, some people in Texas. There was definitely a connection with Lyndon Johnson, and, you know, he was a Texan. And something was, the people who organized the assassination, of course, there were people in Texas. There were people from in the mafia. Of course, if you want to hire some sniper, you have to find him in organized crime. So it doesn't really matter much if he would be a Sicilian or an Israeli or whatever, you know. But what is more interesting, in my view, is to look at the higher level, you know, people who planned the whole thing, who were, you know, on the organization level, and also who had the means not just to organize the crime, but to organize the cover-up. So there, you know, of course, Lyndon Johnson comes first as a suspect number one, of course. And
he just took over. Well, I mean, Kennedy was reigning back Vietnam. He wanted to ramp it up. He had financial investments in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And then there was also Hoover, who was, I guess, as Angleton's boss at the FBI. They were all getting together with these big Texas oil men the night before, according to Johnson's girlfriend, Madeline Brown, I think was her name. But anyway, let's start trying to look at this in a bit more context about the creation of the State of Israel, because a lot of people blame the Brits for all of this, me included. You know, you look at the creation of the United States, this kind of new world, mostly the British involved in the creation of Canada and the United States, North America, and also Israel. Britain played a very important role there with Allenby in the First World War, sweeping away the Ottoman Turks, and then at the end of World War II, the British getting out of the way, making room for the creation of this Israeli state. So this whole business seems to be almost a British project, Laurent.
Well, yeah, but that has nothing to do with Kennedy because, you know, from the time of when David Ben-Gurion became prime minister and minister of defense at the same time, it was just not anymore a British project. It was not at all under British control. Whatever theory we have on the creation of Israel, I know there are different theories. Did the British create Israel, or did the Zionists create Israel? And, you know, how much percentage we can give to one or the other, that's one thing. But at the time of Kennedy, the situation was completely different, you know. David Ben-Gurion was in charge. No one from Britain was telling him what to do. So they had their own agenda, they had their own policy, they had their own vision, their strategy. Their strategy was, of course, to use, originally they kind of played the United States against the USSR, and that's why both recognized Israel in 1948. But then quite quickly, Israel leaned on the United States, and then there were strong connections established, particularly between the Secret Service of Israel and the CIA and James Jesus Angleton. That's where we have to say one word about James Jesus Angleton, because he was the head of the Israel office. And he had the exclusive right to communicate with the Mossad. So no one else in the CIA could communicate with the Mossad unless they go through him. He was also the head of the counterintelligence service. So in other words, trying to find spies on the American soil. And he had some obsession about finding communists. And he had been led to believe that, you know, since so many Israelis came from the USSR, from the Soviet Union area, then, you know, they know much more about the USSR than Americans do. So he established a very strong connection with the Mossad. And in fact, we have quite a few. So he was basically in love with Israel. He was 100% supporting Israel, to the point that the latest biography of James Jesus Angleton it's called The Ghost. And, you know, in this book, the author, I'm sorry, his name escapes me at the moment, important book anyway. Anyway, he shows that he was closer to the Mossad than he was to his own hierarchy. And by the way, he was not under Hoover. The CIA is not under the FBI. He was under Alan Dulles originally, and then under Richard Helms.
Yeah, Jefferson Morley, I think, is the author you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's move forward a little bit to closer to today. We've got a pretty horrific situation going on in Gaza, which is this continued bombing, which has been going on for three or more months now of Gaza. And what many people, including the International Court of Justice in The Hague, are now labelling as a potential genocide. If many people, of course, are saying it is a genocide. This kind of change of direction in the United States with Kennedy's assassination seems to have facilitated this US superpower backing what's going on. I'm not saying the Brits are not involved. We are a little bit. But there seems to be some sort of almost like devil's pact between these two countries, which, you know, if you'd had Democratic presidents of the United States who weren't afraid of being assassinated, you may not have, we may not have come to this situation.
Yeah. Well, actually, it connects very well with Kennedy, because the more I studied about the whole context, you know, where Kennedy came from and what happened after him, the more I realized that this very special relationship between the United States and Israel really started under Johnson. Of course, it had started before, but you know, from the point of view from the time of Lyndon Johnson, Israel gained incredible influence on American foreign policy. You know, in 1967, under the Six-Day War, you know, we know that Lyndon Johnson kind of green-lighted, you know, the Israeli aggression on Egypt. And, you know, there was this USS Liberty affair. So everything changed. And this was also the time, the beginning of the neoconservative. They came, you know, they had their neoconservative conversion around the 1970s, just after Johnson. And so now we have a situation where we feel that the United States is doing something incredibly immoral by supporting Israel, as if now they are totally controlled by Israel, because it's definitely not in the interest of American foreign policy.
Just an anecdote on that, because I think that you're right about the Liberty affair being so important. I think he was called Silurian, who was an anonymous columnist in the Daily Telegraph, did a column, must be around about 2010 or something, 2008 maybe, which had fascinated me, which was about the involvement of George Morrison, the Admiral of the Sixth Fleet, who was the Doors singer, vocalist Jim Morrison's father, being involved in that incident and actually sending from the Sixth Fleet US Phantom jets off to bomb Israel. And literally on the way, those jets, they got orders from the White House, no, don't retaliate, even though the Israelis have attacked one of our ships, bring those jets back.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, this is all sorts of politics involved here. But, you know, at 67, while this was going on, the Admiral's son was like top of the charts in the United States and doing concerts all over the place. And then, of course, a few years later, I think it was 3 or 4 years later, Jim Morrison died in very suspicious circumstances. And basically, he was assassinated. So this is almost at the heart, you know, the culture of the United States was, you know, had integrity. So if the Israelis are going to try and sink an American ship, then they're going to get bombed. But Johnson made the intervention to make sure that there was no retaliation for this attack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He's reported by some Admiral Geis, I think, who claimed that Lyndon Johnson called him personally to ask him to call back the planes. That was not just, he was asked not only not to retaliate, but not to even rescue the crew of the USS Liberty. And the USS Liberty was a spy ship with no weapon, basically. and miraculously stayed afloat. But you know, the purpose was to sink it without any survivor, in order to blame it on Egypt and draw the United States into the war. So Lyndon Johnson covered this Israeli crime. You know, there was no, it was covered up, and you know, the survivors were asked to not say a word under the threat of prison or worse. And so, you know, Lyndon Johnson, when you realize, when, you know, Lyndon Johnson was probably, you know, a person with incredible personal ambition, but he was also basically from the beginning of his political career in 1948, he was Israel's man. And, you know, he had always been financed. He brought, when he, as soon as he got into the White House, he brought, you know, all those people who infiltrated, you know, the White House, the Pentagon, you know, the State Department. And that was the beginning of the situation we had during already the time of 9/11, which I believed was an Israeli job, or a neoconservative job, if you want. But neoconservatives, in my opinion, are basically should be called crypto-Zionists. They are people... Yeah.
Well, I think for anyone that's doubting that, there's a very good article on the WikiSpooks website, 9/11 Israel Did It All, The Proof in the World, which really goes through a fantastic amount of evidence of this really being part of a geostrategic project, which, if not led by Israel, most definitely benefits Israel. The idea really being as part of the Yinon plan to balkanize the Middle East, to give the United States excuses to intervene all over the place, really, and providing a sort of media, press, propaganda cover for those sorts of investigations. But anyway, look, before we get off the subject of the Kennedy brothers too much, there was the assassination of Robert Kennedy was particularly interesting in that it involved this sort of principle of mind control, MK Ultra, the idea that somebody could be brainwashed to do a killing, and even if they didn't succeed, there would be a real assassin there to make sure the person was finished off if this mind control zombie malfunctioned.
Exactly, that's it. You summarize it. It's it's quite shocking to the case is very clear, actually, and actually Robert Kennedy's son has studied that, and he's absolutely convinced that Sirhan actually did not shoot his father, because he shot with his revolver, but he was not aiming correctly, and Robert Kennedy was shot from behind, not by Sirhan, and Sirhan doesn't remember anything, and psychiatrist confirmed that he doesn't remember. So there's definitely many people have, many specialists, experts, you know, have concluded that he must have been hypnotized. So that brings, to mind MK Ultra and all these kind of things. It's quite amazing story. But what is even more amazing is that this Sirhan, this patsy, if you want, or this Manchurian candidate or whatever, was a Palestinian. And still today, just a few days ago, again, I read, there was a conference by Robert Kennedy, and he was introduced by a rabbi. It was in some kind of a synagogue or something. And the rabbi claimed again that Robert Kennedy, so, you know, Bobby Jr.'s father, he was introducing Bobby Jr. And he said his father was killed because he loved Israel so much. He was killed by a man who hated Israel. So, you know, that's an incredible story, an incredible thing, because in my view, you know, Robert Kennedy was killed by the same people who killed his brother. And I think it was basically Israel, in the very general term that I explained before, with many people involved, of course, in the United States. So, you know, they managed to kill Robert Kennedy because Robert Kennedy was definitely not a friend of Israel. No Kennedy has been especially a friend of Israel, at least until recently. So, you know, they managed to get him killed by a Palestinian so that they can claim Robert as some kind of martyr who died because of his love of Israel, killed by a Palestinian terrorist.
Mm. Yeah, and Robert Kennedy was killed in June 1968, as we've described, by supposedly by Sirhan Sirhan, only it was that he wasn't. He was also getting very much involved in producing a weekly, or maybe it was a monthly, magazine. So this is a kind of lifestyle magazine, but it also had some very incisive articles about politics. So he picked some journalists who were particularly critical of the mafia. So in a way, what you're describing here, if we can just take a step back from it all, is a kind of international mafia that has as its fronts the government of the United States, maybe Britain and Israel too. Really, it's just a kind of interconnected mafiosi.
My view is not exactly that. I think it is definitely a Zionist plot, and by which I mean people who are absolutely dedicated to the state of Israel, to the survival and the expansion, and to make Israel, you know, the pole of the regional center of power. You know, and the nuclear policy of Israel, it goes into that direction. As I said, you know, Israel is determined to have the nuclear bomb, which they have because of Kennedy's assassination. If Kennedy had not been assassinated, Israel would not have atomic power, nuclear power. And perhaps also some Arab states would have. So, you know, I'm talking more about an Israeli plot. Of course, Israel is an international organization, you know, in some way. That's what is very special about this state. It is both a state with frontiers and also some kind of international organization, because there are Zionists working for Israel, inside the United States in particular. But I would more emphasize the national dimension rather than the international dimension. That's what I mean.
What's the relationship like between France and the United States? Because there's this kind of, I think, isn't it the biggest statue in the world still? It might not quite be, but the Statue of Liberty, which was sent over to New York. And it's still a massive symbol of the United States. I mean, it's on their coinage and things like that. And but this is actually a gift from the French. So what was going on there?
Yeah, but that's a long time ago, you know. In the 60s, we had De Gaulle. De Gaulle was the man who wanted to try to keep France in a neutral position between the United States and the USSR. So he was also he was definitely not, at the time, France was definitely not controlled by the United States under De Gaulle. And so I don't think
isn't there this sort of revolutionary link, the idea that, you know, the Statue of Liberty represents the French Revolution and the American Revolution?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, the United States is founded on the French Enlightenment, you know. It's founded on the democratic ideal, which was kind of theorized by the French at the beginning, Rousseau and so on. So, you know, they loved the French. You know, the Statue of Liberty was made by the French because, you know, it symbolizes this kind of French Enlightenment route of the United States.
And what about Freemasonry? Are you interested in that? Have you looked into that? Because, you know, the Grand Orient in France is quite powerful. Obviously, the founders of the United States were Freemasons. Many, if not all, modern US presidents have been Freemasons. Does this play a role?
Well, you know, I think I'm not a specialist of Freemasonry, but I tend to think many people were, you know, into Freemasonry in one way or another. It was not the Grand Orient de France at that time, I suppose. It was more a British thing, actually. And Freemasonry, you know, emerged in the 18th century in Britain. Then it spread in France and in Germany. But, you know, for a long time, I my view is that the origin of Freemasonry is just people who gathered because, you know, they wanted to talk freely about religion, about metaphysics, about God, about the world and so on, without, you know, without trying to avoid clerical persecution, whether they were in Catholic countries or so, you know, they adopted, you know, I think there are different kinds of Freemasonry, you know, so it was just clubs for people to talk about democracy and to talk about God. And
it's well, that's right. I mean, it's a speakeasy, but it was also a secret society, you know. So when the general society nowadays, we have quite a bit of freedom of speech here in the West, although you might not say the same about Julian Assange. Back in those days, it wasn't like that. You know, it was if you spoke out of turn, you could be arrested for heresy or whatever. Exactly. But anyway, look, let's bring the whole discussion right up to date and have a look at what's going on now in the Middle East, particularly because we've got an increasing tension between the United States and Iran, which is directly connected to these blockade by the Yemenis of the Red Sea. And also, of course, the Israeli, well, you could even call it a holocaust in Gaza, with something like 30,000 civilians now being massacred in what the Israelis call their mowing of the lawn, which they do every few years. So this is probably one of the most horrific we've ever seen. So can you just try and pick apart what the real motives are behind this killing in Gaza?
Well, yeah, but just before you mention Iran, so I think that's important to, you know, it's getting quite clear. And actually, this American scholar, Mersheimer, what's his first name? I forgot. He speaks quite a lot about it. You know, he is the author, one of the author of the book, The Israel Lobby. He quite often points out that who wants the United States to go to war against Iran? You know, it's Israel. Very clear. Netanyahu, you know, is pushing for the United States to go to war against Iran already for 20 years. So that's a good example of what's really going on, what's the really the real relationship between the United States and Israel. Who, you know, is it the tail who wags that wags the dog or the opposite? You know, so Iran is Israel is really in control at the moment of the American foreign policy. And about Gaza, I think that's you know, that's another example in the sense that it's totally an initiative of Israel. I mean, of course, they responded to the attack of the Hamas, but they used it and they blew it. They overreacted, but it was probably planned. Anyway, I don't know the detail. I have no special insight on the details.
Well, I can tell you they definitely got a warning it was going to happen, and they had a whole plan to deal with it, which was not brought into action. And there was a very slow reaction to it on October the 7th. There's also the fact many of those Israelis deaths which are blamed on Hamas were actually people who were being killed by the Israeli Defense Forces, who had a very I think isn't it called the Hannibal policy, where they rather than allow hostages to be taken away, they would prefer for them to be killed by their own side. So lots of questions about that, definitely.
I mean, absolutely. I hope it will. I think it is coming out even in the Israeli press, I suppose. Even Haaretz talks a little bit about those things. So I hope the Israeli population will realize what incredible, you know, how incompetent and totally, you know, the job that the Israeli soldiers did was really incredibly messy.
Can you talk a bit about what you think the actual real motives at the bottom are for this this slaughter? I mean, it doesn't
in Gaza. Well, I think it's just the logical it's one step on the Israeli agenda. Look what they did since 1948. They were not satisfied with the partition plan of the United Nations, so they took over thousands of villages and kicked out about 500,000 Arabs. Then in 1967, they doubled the size of their country. They took over. Of course, they had to give back some of it under pressure. And now they're taking over Gaza, and they are getting more and more confident about being able to do things which are totally out of international law and get away with it, because they've gotten away with every sanction from the United Nations without any consequences. So I think it's logical. They did it because they could do it, because they wanted to do it, and that was a good time. And everything, the good time means generally when there is a war going on somewhere. You know, the Russians are busy in Ukraine. So, you know, in the mind of these strategic people in Israel, they choose the right moment to expand. What they want is expand, basically. So they expanded already in many different areas. Now they want to take back Gaza. And the only way to do it is to do some kind of ethnic cleansing, what they're doing now, which is, another word for genocide. So, you know, again, I emphasize here the motive is totally national, but Israel has a mean, has the way to get the support of the United States, and whatever the United States does, Europe follows in terms of foreign policy. So now Israel is supported by the United States and the European states. But that's not because the United States wanted this situation. I don't think they wanted it, especially at this moment, because going to cost Biden his place as president, among other things, of course.
Do you want to say something about the European Union and France's place in it, Britain's place in it? Because it does seem as if this is almost a kind of remaking of the United States of America or United States of Europe. There's something similar going on.
In Europe, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, well, in the EU, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Before that, can you, if you don't mind, I want to add something, because in Israel, you know, what really shocked me, you know, it made me think a lot, and, you know, I produced a couple or two or three articles around that theme, is that Netanyahu started to quote the Bible. You know, he started to say, remember Amalek. And we are remembering Amalek as our holy Bible is telling us, and our soldiers is fighting, you know, Israeli soldiers 3,000 years ago, led by Joshua and this kind of thing. So he started to speak about the Bible and to explain the aggression of Gaza in biblical terms. So I felt it was a good opportunity to realize, you know, that Israel is very biblical. You know, the Bible, or the Hebrew Bible, you know, for them is not necessarily a religious book. It's a kind of reference. It's the national narrative. It's their identity. They believe they are the country that, you know, was founded 3,000 years ago, and chosen by God or whatever, or chosen by themselves, depending on if they are religious or not. But they are involved into behaving in a biblical way, and it's actually in their in the Declaration of Independence in 1948. It was very clear. They claim they recreate Israel, you know, so they are the same Israel as the Israel of biblical times. And Israel of biblical times went around genociding the Amalek and the Midianite and a few other people. So that's their justification. And I know that Christians don't like to see this and to hear this, because they want to protect the Bible. And I felt kind of called to point out, you know, do you know what's in the Bible? Do you know about Amalek? You know, so you think God ordered Israel to massacre the Amalekites in the ancient times, but now you don't want Israel to massacre the people of Gaza. So, you know, there is a deep embarrassment and contradiction within Christian culture regarding Israel.
Well, I totally understand, and it does seem as if something pretty amazing is brewing, almost a kind of, many people using this term Armageddon to describe this conflict that's brewing up now between the Muslim world, particularly, and the Zionists. So can you say something about that? Because, you know, there is this potential. We've already got the United States and the Russian troops in the region, in Syria and Iraq. And, you know, the Chinese have made it absolutely clear that that they take the very much the side of the Palestinians and the Palestinian state. So, I mean, if things start really kicking off in the Middle East, it could easily turn into a third world war.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think some people want it to turn into a world war. Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly dangerous because we have, and that's connected to the biblical thinking, as you mentioned. You know, this. I'm not interested personally in eschatology and studying prophecies and so on, because I believe, you know, it's more that if you think that way, you will create the situation. If you think about Armageddon, and if you think that making things worse until you get a world war, then you will bring God into, you know, into the scene in some way or whatever. It just helps making it happen. And that's, you know, that's exactly what I mean by we have a biblical country there, who is thinking in biblical terms. No, it doesn't matter if they're religious or not. You know, Israel is a biblical country. So, and Islam also, Islamic thinking is also very eschatological. So many people, yes, feel that there's something that is, we are getting closer to the final, messianic time, or many people feel like that, but that's not
stop it happening by burying your head in the sand. I think it's quite important to understand that the motivations of the people that, you know, for many of us, we shy away, probably the vast majority, shy away from any thought that somebody might actually want to have a third world war and delight in it, because, I mean, there are these, you have to use this word, evil forces out there, because some of what we've been describing is evil. The assassination of the US President Kennedy was most definitely an evil act. The genocide in Gaza is evil. The killing of the European Jews who didn't support Zionism in World War II by the Germans, and the working of them to death, was also evil. So this is definitely a battle between good and evil going on, surely.
Yeah, sure. It's, that's what interesting is, to try to see, you know, spiritual forces working behind history. And, I don't say, you know, everything can be explained by spiritual forces, but it's interesting to look at it, yeah, in the very long term, and to see the evolution. And at the moment, I think we have many people have a sense that, you know, the Western world has become really evil, you know, under the leadership of the United States. The United States has become really an evil empire, you know, desperate to keep its hegemony on the world, and ready to play any kind of evil games to do it, including, of course, sacrificing whole countries, because Ukraine, for example, is, you know, they couldn't care less about the Ukrainians. So they are sacrificing the Ukrainian people in order to, you know, to play their geostrategic great game with Russia. And in Gaza, I think it's a little bit different. I don't think it's the United States. I don't think it's OTAN, you know, the NATO. I don't think NATO, you know, wanted this war in Gaza. I think it's totally an Israeli, because that's what they do. You know, when they see the world situation getting hot, they know it's a good time for them to do what they want to do, because people will be too busy somewhere else. Look at 1967, you know, when they launched their Six-Day War. You know, people were very busy with Vietnam. In the United States, people were going into the down in the street to demonstrate against Vietnam. Nobody went down the street to protest against the Israeli aggression. So World War is always a good opportunity for some nations, and Israel in particular.
You did talk about your interest in basically this is history, really, particularly around the Mediterranean, talking about Byzantium. What do you make of the way that history has evolved with these organized? I mean, like, for example, the Phoenicians finally being gotten rid of by the Romans. Mm-hmm. The Phoenicians, of course, were extremely secretive and very efficient traders. They were trading, many believe, even with the Americas, 1500, 1000 BC. Mm. And there is evidence that the Phoenicians were over there. You talked about, I think you said it was Byzantium that had almost been erased from history. It seems that there is actually a history out there which is not really talked about. And there's a kind of almost a false version put in its place. Say, for example, with the Greeks and the Romans, it's almost as if they were the start of something, where actually they were just continuing something that had been going on for many thousands of years.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Byzantium has been one of my major interests for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, because I started with my interest for Russia. You know, when I started to get to try to understand Russia, then quickly I realized Russian Orthodoxy is really Byzantine Orthodoxy, or coming from there. And I started to be interested in the Orthodox world and in the history. And I quickly realized that, there is a big hole in our worldview, in our medieval worldview, in what people, in what the average people knows about the Middle Age. You know, when we think about the Middle Age, we think about European Middle Ages, and we completely ignore that the biggest city in the whole Mediterranean world was Constantinople, and Constantinople was the bridge between East and West, and so I started to feel and investigate that there is a big lie in our own, in the autobiography of the West, you know, the West, how the West sees its own history. It is connected to the Crusades, because the Western world, Western Christianity, Western Christendom, let's say, destroyed Eastern Christendom, especially in 1204 with the Fourth Crusade, where Constantinople was sacked by the Crusaders. And that was the beginning of the end for Constantinople. So after Constantinople fell, you know, finally, kind of survived, you know, but in a very small way until the Ottomans took it over. You know, during that time, the Western world was getting enriched by the culture of Byzantium, and later came the Renaissance, which was basically, you know, it really came from Byzantium, from Constantinople. So there is a phenomena where the Western world imagined its own history and emphasized its roots in Rome and in Athens, but wanted to erase, to forget, to deny that, in fact, all they got was from Byzantium. For example, all the Greek cultures, the Greek culture, you know, the philosophers, the historians, the tragedy, and so on, came through Constantinople. You know, the Latins, the Franks, the Europeans did not get it directly from Greece, or did not get it primarily from the Arabs, as sometimes is said, but basically it was coming from the libraries of Constantinople. So it's very strange to realize that we have a very biased view of the Middle Age, and it's connected to what's going on today in my mind, because there is something much deeper than I thought in terms of resentment between the East and the West. It goes back to the destruction of Eastern Christianity by Western Christianity. But Eastern Christianity was not completely destroyed. It was inherited by Russia. Russia is today the Orthodox Russia. Moscow is the new Constantinople, is the third Rome for the Russians. See it this way, because they collected the heritage of Byzantium before Byzantium died. So, and Russia has a similar position as Byzantium in the past in terms of being the connector between East and West. You know, that's why Russia is looking East and looking West, exactly like Byzantium was looking toward Persia and toward Rome. So there is some kind of strange geopolitical story that is being replayed, you know. Something that is what is happening today in terms of the clash of civilization between the Western world and the Russian world or the Orthodox world is somehow a repetition or a continuation of what was going on between Rome and Constantinople in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I mean, one of the things the Orthodox Church still has is this thing called the Oath Crime, which is taken from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where he says, never swear an oath. Simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else comes from the devil, and which is a pretty strong way of putting it. And so anybody that's joining any kind of thing like Freemasonry or any kind of secret society and swearing these oaths is going against the Bible. And the Orthodox Church, as far as I know, is probably the only church, certainly the Roman Church and the Protestant Church and the other Western churches don't really make any fuss about it. It's almost as if the Protestants were nicely arranged to accommodate Freemasonry and mercantile capitalism. But what about 2000? Because something happened in Russia, didn't it? The country was being raped effectively mostly by Swiss trained oligarchs, and this guy Putin turned up. So what do you make of modern Russia under Putin?
Well, I'm quite hopeful that Putin is doing something, is going in the right direction. He's leading the world toward, you know, multipolarity, and I feel this concept of multipolarity is definitely good, definitely going in the right direction, trying to establish a new balance of powers, you know, based on trust, based on the law, international law. I think Putin emphasizes this a lot because he accuses the United States to work by the rules, not by the law, you know, by the rules that they make. And he wants to restore, he is very strongly attached to the United Nations. And personally, I feel this is the only way to get to some point, even though, of course, the United Nations have to evolve, has many things have to change. But it is still an organization that is able to say the law, to say international law, to say who is right and who is wrong. And that's why Israel has been outlawed by the United Nations quite a lot. So I feel if Putin succeeds together with the Chinese and the BRICS and other countries to create such a world, I'm not saying this is going to be perfect, but definitely this is going to mean the end of a system which is very evil at the moment, which is the way that the United States want to maintain their hegemony through wars, through, you know, creating wars and threatening countries, and you know, and this is a the United States are and Israel together are, you know, rogue countries today. They are the only really rogue countries in the world. So yeah, I'm quite hopeful, but of course I don't want to be naive, and I know Putin is not the Messiah either. So
well, no, I mean, they were all kind of gangsters, but Putin, it seems to me, in 2000, in getting rid of Berezovsky, who's the chief oligarch who owned the NTV, the first private TV channel. He also had the franchise for Mercedes, various other things. He was involved in the flotation of the shares of Aeroflot, the national airline, that sort of thing. That Putin's first, one of his first moves was to call him up and say, well, I'm afraid they're going to come and arrest you and I can't stop them on Monday, so get out of the country, Mr. Berezovsky, and I'll see what I can do. And so he got on a plane to London, and that was it, really. By making sure that the chief oligarch was out of the country, that sent a message to all of the other oligarchs about who was in charge and whether or not the mafia over there were going to really be able to interfere in whatever the Kremlin did. I think it was, yeah, it's quite a bold move, and it was decisive in making the Russians a really truly independent force in the world. I did ask you briefly about the European Union. What do you make of the way this has evolved from the Second World War onwards?
Well, I think I personally try to have a balanced position, because more and more I feel we're moving toward, you know, multipolarity, and multipolarity means nations, independent nations will have no place unless they organize politically in order to have a political voice, a political will, and so on. So I'm from that point of view, I'm more a pro-European. You know, I feel French people who are talking constantly about French sovereignty and trying to imagine that France can have a role as an international power, I feel they are very naive. So I think we need a Europe. But of course, the Europe we need is not the Europe that exists today. And the question is whether it's better to destroy this Europe completely and see what we can build on it, or if this Europe can be transformed. But I'm quite afraid that at this moment, Europe has been basically hijacked by, I'm not saying it has been created by the United States, but I think it has been hijacked by the United States. In other words, I mean, Europe was needed. Europe was a necessity after the Second World War. And many people say it who are not pro-American at all. You know, many intellectuals at that time felt if Europe cannot organize politically, then we will be swallowed by the United States. And that's what happened. So at the moment, the European Union is basically like a vassal of the United States.
Yeah, and it certainly is. with this Nord Stream pipeline being blown up by Jake Sullivan and his friends from the National Security Council, and the Germans saying, OK, fine, and just shrugging their shoulders and walking away. I mean, amazing, exactly. Really.
That's really so beautiful. Yeah, that's the best. That's the best illustration. And I hope the Germans realize, you know, because it's incredible proof that their government is completely unable, incapable of saying anything to the United States, even though, you know, it's really an incredible event.
Another thing that's been in the news here in Britain, finally, Laura, is this guy, Valdo Calacane, who's an African guy, who decided he was going to carry knives around late at night last year and start killing people. But one of the most interesting things that came out in the reporting of this case after he was convicted, 32-year-old guy in Nottingham, actually killed two students as they were walking home. And then he went on and killed a school caretaker, hijacked his van and tried to drive it into people to kill them too. He claims that he doesn't claim it. He actually did travel down to London, 150 miles or so, to actually visit MI5's headquarters at Thames House, walked in and said, please arrest me as I'm being controlled by you. And so this is a phenomenon we've seen quite a lot, is these mental patients sort of roaming the streets and randomly killing people. And every single time there has been many warning signs for the police beforehand, but the police have not been intervening. So I wonder, because this for me harkens back to the old Sirhan Sirhan case, where the secret services do seem to be involved in this. And here in Britain, I don't know what the situation is in France. We had a law passed in 2019 which everyone was sort of their eyebrows were raised when we found out that government agencies could not be prosecuted for any crimes, including serious crimes as high as murder. So there seems to be always a get out clause for MI5 to, if they want to, experiment with mental patients as sort of Manchurian candidates roaming the streets and killing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite possible. It makes you think of MKUltra and these kind of things. Yes. I mean, I don't know the case in detail. I'm not going to investigate it. And I also think that we live in a crazy world and many people are getting crazy. And, people are uprooted. People are brainwashed by the media. People watch terrible things on television or on video. So I'm not, I think this kind of society produces insane people who can go around in the streets and kill people. What he did by itself is no evidence that he was used by the MI5, but definitely what you tell me, I hadn't heard about this case. So that's strange. And I definitely believe that secret services or intelligence services like MI5 or the CIA are still experimenting with drugs, with brainwashing and these kind of things. I have no evidence of it, but they're also experimenting with viruses. So why would they not experiment with engineering the brain of people? And I think that's quite a possibility.
I mean, it's almost like a kind of occult dream, isn't it, for centuries, this idea of, a remote control person that will do whatever you want. I don't know what they are, homunculus or golem or, anyway, to create a sort of Frankenstein character that you can sort of control like a puppeteer. But anyway, look, Lauren, it's been fascinating chatting with you. Can you just let us know where best places for people to follow you? Listeners can pick you up online or elsewhere.
Well, I think the best is I'm writing articles on the UNZ Review, UNZ.com, by Ron UNZ. And basically everything I write, I publish there, and then sometimes it can be found somewhere else. But otherwise, I have a few books, on Kennedy, on 9/11 and from Yahweh to Zion.
Can you run through your titles of your books, please?
Well, one of them is called From Yahweh to Zion. Then another one is called, let me see, which is a kind of, about a dozen articles from the UNZ Review that I published under the title Our God is Your God Too, But He Has Chosen Us. Our God is your God too, but He has chosen us, which I feel is, summarize it's subtitled Essays on Jewish Power. And then my book on Kennedy is titled The Unspoken Kennedy Truth. And that's it. Yeah. But if you go on the UNZ Review and you put my name there, and you'll find all my articles on the Kennedys, on 9/11, on Israel, and on world affairs in general. It's a great webzine, as I say, the UNZ Review.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, it was created by Ron UNZ. He writes himself quite a lot of those articles, and he gets into all the conspiratorial subject. But he has a very scholarly and, quite a sane intellectual mind. And so it's generally quite high standard. You can read about history of civilization there, but mostly it's about world affairs at this moment, a lot of articles on Gaza. And that's where I publish anyway. I'm very comfortable to publish there because there's a good readership and... Yeah, and then there's this film, under Kennedy. It's called Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers. And then there's another one called 9/11 and Israel's Great Games. You can find it on Odyssey or...
Yeah, and in fact, probably on YouTube too. As you know, these are quite popular films. In fact, people have been downloading them and re-uploading them onto the platforms where they've been previously banned. But I think we'll finish where we started, just in my recommending people to have a watch of Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers by Laurent Guillenot, who we're talking to now, which came out in 2020. Laurent, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. I enjoyed it.